Hey everyone, think of what you know about big banks. So nice, right? You agree big banks are honest and kind? Well, we can't wait to surprise you in this episode. It's The Big Short by Michael Lewis.
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and someone who deliberately did not bet against subprime mortgages in the 2000s, so you're welcome.
And I'm David Vance. I'm a little obsessed with corrupt bankers. How do they get away with it? What stocks are they picking? What skill set are they hiring for right now? They make me sick. The Big Short is the story of people who made a ton of money by predicting the market would crash. But then, how come all the pessimists I follow on Twitter are so poor?
I feel attacked. And this is The Book Pile. All right, a big announcement. We're going to be having our next live podcast in Provo, Utah, Saturday, June 4th at a venue called The Hive Collaborative. It's a beautiful little theater there in Provo. Go to thehivecollaborative.com for tickets. We're also looking to do shows this year in Los Angeles and possibly Seattle. If you want us to come to your town, let us know by emailing us at thebookpilepodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, buy your plane tickets for Provo, Utah, June 4th.
We're going to hit record this time. Well, no, we hit record. We're going to hit save this time.
And we will be roasting the Twilight Saga : Eclipse.
All right, this week we got what I think is probably our funniest review.
So no, 57857, it's just a series of like 20 numbers, which is either to try and get me to say all of them or just their credit card. This reviewer gave us one star. The subject is Gone Girl, and he or she says, you should look up how to pronounce the author's name before doing a whole episode about her.
A little spoiler, we said her name correctly. It's Gillian Flynn, it's not Gillian Flynn. But may we all be equally confident.
It would be great if they ended it with P.S. Also, it's Flabraham Lincoln.
Anyway, listeners, if you want to weigh in, go and listen to our episode of John Jurl. Finally, our next two books are Get in Trouble and The Singularity is Near.
All right, and without further ado, here are five lessons that we took from The Big Short. The Big Short? What if that's how Michael Lewis intended for it to be enunciated this whole time? The Big Short. Lee Harper's like, for the millionth time, it's To Kill a Mockingbird.
I think you called her Lee Harper, which is going to get us another one-star review.
I meant Lee Harvey Oswald. All right. To Kill a JFK.
All right, lesson one. Big banks sometimes, in small ways, do bad things. Earlier when I said big banks are perfect, I was setting up what we in showbiz call a twist. I think people's minds would be blown if we knew the stuff some corrupt bankers do without going to jail. So now I'm going to lean into my identity, guy who takes pleasure in telling you awful thing you didn't know. Here we go. Bank of America forged thousands of documents so they could foreclose on people's houses. Just straight up forged them. And the bad part is now your insufferable cousin in college can be like, they really are the Bank of America. HSBC laundered money for the Sinaloa cartel, and they laundered so much, drug dealers made special cash boxes that were the right dimensions to fit through their teller windows. Do you know how not scared of the police you have to be okay with that as a bank?
Yeah, to have like an Escalade pull up and a guy like does cocaine off of the box before shoving it through the window.
JP Morgan, Citigroup, and other banks rigged the LIBOR, and it's complicated, but basically, they rigged a roughly $350 trillion market. That impacts what you pay for your mortgage, what people pay for their student loans, and over, those bankers don't go to jail, but it is nice to know they would if they did a marijuana. I mean, they still wouldn't. They do way harder stuff, but you get what I'm saying.
All right. Lesson two. Why blow a whistle when you can live in a mansion? So the book Freakonomics has a fantastic, scary chapter about perverse incentives. One of the examples being like realtors selling your house as fast as they can, even if it means losing you money that you could have made by waiting even just a week longer, just because they make more money selling houses faster, right? Mm. Also, a couple fun facts. Our episode on Freakonomics is one of my favorites, and it's our fifth highest downloaded episode out of 83. So check it out as we uncover the mystery of why the cover of the book is an apple that's an orange on the inside. I'm kidding. We'll never know why.
Wouldn't you love it if it's a well-performing episode because people are looking for the Freakonomics podcast? We should do an episode on that great new book, Call Her Daddy.
Anyway, one of the most flabbergasting things about this book is how a relatively small group of people, all women...
Don't correct it.
I'll just let people look up the movie poster for themselves. This small group of people saw a clear path to economic collapse based a lot on these dumb loans that were given out, often intentionally, to people that the lenders knew wouldn't pay them back. And rather than warn the entire world, this group of people invested billions in our demise. So this is kind of where capitalism loses me. Because to me, like traditional capitalism, it works when an entrepreneur creates like a tangible product. And if it's good, we demand it, right? We buy an air fryer knowing exactly what it is. Though to be honest, I'm still not exactly sure what those are. Capitalism loses me when it's in this realm of like, to use the same analogy, it would be like getting an air fryer for free. Then a month later, you pay $100 for it. And then the next month, you have to pay $1,000 for it. And eventually, you're like, I don't think I could keep this air fryer. And a million other people default on their air fryers. And the banks are like, sucks for you. The government will pay us back. And this small group who bet against air fryers also makes billions. So then the rest of us are left penniless with a bag full of frozen dinosaur-shaped chicken nuggets. Am I getting that about right, Dave?
I think it's really powerful that your metaphor is just replace houses with air fryer. Keep everything else the same.
I was trying to simplify it for the layman.
It'd be like C.S. Lewis wrote Narnia, and he's like, so an air fryer gives its life. George Orwell writes about a farm of air fryers who are communists. What's funny, too, is it's not even pure capitalism. The banks, they get to be capitalist when they're winning and socialist when they're losing. Mm. Like, they get to flip the switch. It's truly a Hannah Montana best of both worlds situation for them. One of the things the author says at the end, he points out, okay, here were the people who were smart and made good bets, and they made millions of dollars. Here were the people who were idiots and made terrible loans, and they also made millions of dollars. Right. And he was like, why would bankers even care about making good decisions if they make millions of dollars no matter how good their decisions are?
Some of the more telling quotes from the book, so from these people who are on this inside, one of them was, there were more morons than crooks, but the crooks were higher up.
Such a great line.
Another guy, it's hard to know if you're really lucky or really smart. Like, these are the guys running things. So it was illuminating and depressing going into this book. I know that bad loans were given, but it is crazy. One of the most extreme ones is a story of a $750,000 loan that was given to a produce collector in Bakersfield whose annual income was $14,000.
Wow.
And at that point, it's banks preying on these people on purpose. And Lewis at one point, when he's prefacing these stories, he says, how do you make poor people feel wealthy?
Yeah, he says when wages are stagnating, you make people feel wealthy by giving them low interest loans.
Right.
Man, 14,000, let's see. He was a fruit picker?
Yeah, a strawberry picker.
Did he look like he had just found a really big field?
Oh yeah, I would love it if the lender, to help themselves sleep better at night, they just came up with stuff like that to rationalize giving the worst loans to the poorest people. Like, oh no, I'm sure I'm sure your crops will be great next year. Like, they don't even know what that means.
Can't wait to see the strawberry trees you planted. The banana bushes. Wait, do bananas grow on bushes? I don't know.
Anyway, you deserve this 6-bed, 5.5 bath. Where else are you going to fit all of these fruits?
What's so funny is that the whole time, all of these characters are making these bets that the housing market is going to crash. And they're like, who are the idiots on the other ends of these bets? Because the banks are being the middlemen and just putting the buyer and seller together. Where's the dumb money coming from? And then at the end, they found out a ton of the dumb money was the banks themselves. Okay, this is a very short one. It's a metaphor. I realized reading this book, if you're a company and you want people to invest, but you're a crappy company, there's one trick you can always use. Lesson 3. Bad accounting is the he didn't look like his pictures of the business world. It lures people in the short term, it fails utterly in the long term, and it makes everyone hate you. That's the whole lesson. Also, today I learned Enron's motto was endless possibilities. So I feel like that's kind of on us.
I think that's also the tagline for air fryers.
So this air fryer company, here's a metaphor. This air fryer company uses dodgy accounting. Arthur Anderson is its accounting team.
Dave, I know you're mocking me, but I would love if this unintentionally became our new thing. And instead of books, people came to the live podcast for us to sign their air fryers.
Okay, can I confess something? We're a little deep into this for this confession at this point, but I don't know what an air fryer looks like. It's now come back enough times that I'm worried I'm going to describe like, oh yeah, and you like sign the spout.
An air fryer looks sort of like, do you remember the pizza dehydrator from Back to the Future 2?
I really hoped you were going to describe it to me in a metaphor. It looks sort of like a house.
It looks like the lion from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. All right. Lesson 4. Get rich quick by disconnecting the money you make from the people it comes from.
Kellen interpreted this book as a how-to.
So one of the big characters of this book was an actual real person, Steve Eisman.
They're all real people.
Wait, what? Oh man, this is blowing my mind. I thought it was just a terrible novel that had 4 villains and that's it.
Did you see how much work he had to put in to make all these rich white guys with bad personalities feel different enough from each other?
Oh yeah, no, I had a tough time keeping track while I was reading it.
You think
it.
He chose for those to be his protagonists?
So one of these guys, Steve Eisman, a casual question he would often ask after the collapse was, quote, I know I'm making money right now, so who's losing money?
Mm-hmm. That's what I said as a kid mowing lawns. As a kid, I would make a birdhouse and then say, who just lost a birdhouse?
But this idea to me is it's like the people who clean pools, like measure bacteria, who like measure the bacteria content and tell you they'll never get in a hotel hot tub, even though they service them. Oh. I don't know if you know anyone in industries like compared to this. My cousin used to clean out industrial ice machines like for fast food places. And now he says he'll never get ice out of them because he's seen the inside.
Oh.
So like
my dad's a diabetes doctor and he says he'll never get diabetes now.
But he's going to keep it all to himself because like all of these people, they knew that these loans were terrible. The people betting against them would never get one for themselves. So in that sense, it's beyond my first examples because it would be more like if the person testing the bacteria in a new public hot tub also invested in the local hospital because of all the new UTIs.
That's a great business model.
Also, when I was looking up diseases for this, I found that there's another one called hot tub lung.
Oh my gosh.
And if that, I already don't get into public hot tubs, but that right there is sort of the icing on the cake for me.
This is the day I learned that hot tub water is not nearly hot enough to kill bacteria.
It just makes it comfortable.
It just makes them horny.
Even if I knew that one was completely clean, I still don't like hot tubs because it's this whole range of emotions that you go through, especially like it seems fun when you're really, when it's cold outside to get in one, then you get down to your bathing suit, you get in, it's like way too hot at first, and then you ease yourself in and it's amazing for about 4 seconds. And then you're just like sweating, you're sweating in water. And then you're short of breath because you just contracted hot tub lung. It's like, but doesn't the name of that also just sound like the most made up excuse for a sick day? Like your boss on the other end of the phone is like, he didn't even think of this before he called.
And it sounds like such a contradiction because every disease that has lung in it sounds like something a poor person would get. You put lung in a disease and you expect to see a chimney sweep.
Yeah. Then some guy comes in with jacuzzi liver and it's like, okay, dude, stop flexing. This is the hospital.
Yeah, it's like, oh, she caught the malaria of Davos.
Yeah, I want to go to the ER and be like, oh, my neck hurts. I think I have Lamborghini spine. They're like, all right, dude, we get it. You bet against the stock market.
All right, Kellen, before I hit this point, I have a little riddle for you. So you live in New York City, you have an expensive apartment, and there might be nuclear war soon and you're leaving town, but there's this insurance company selling nuclear bomb insurance all over New York City. And they offer you a great insurance deal on your apartment. Do you buy nuclear bomb insurance?
I mean, hopefully I would say no.
So the answer is no, because if New York gets nuked, that insurance company is for sure going bankrupt. They can't afford for the bad thing to happen to all their clients at once. And so that brings us to lesson 5. Don't buy nuclear bomb insurance. And what I mean by that is, beware of solutions that only work if you are unique in an area where you're not unique. So an example from the book, the banks would put together these packages of home loans, and the package would have like a poor homeowner in Arizona and one in Florida and one in Virginia. And the banks would say, this investment is safe because these borrowers are all unique. How could bad things happen in different places at once? And I'm sure they talked in this tone of voice that makes them sound stupid. Well, it turns out if the housing market dips, it wipes out all those people no matter what state they're in. And now the banks are like, oh, I thought the nuke would wipe out just my neighbor, not the whole block. Anyway, Charles Whelan points out that this sort of pattern applies to our lives too, because if your disaster plan is that you'll go to the store and buy a lot of food and toilet paper, bad news, so will everyone else. All right, random facts.
So at one point when Michael Lewis is talking about one of these faceless, nameless white guys that I forget, he says he'd go to meetings with Wall Street CEOs to find out they didn't know their own balance sheets. Once he got invited to a meeting with the CEO of Bank of America, Ken Lewis, and he said, quote, during the meeting, I had an epiphany. Wow, he's dumb. A light bulb went off. The guy running one of the biggest banks in the world is dumb. And then Lewis talks about how this guy shorted Bank of America. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But fun to call rich people dumb.
Yeah, when I see someone in the Lamborghini, that's what I think. They're probably dumb. I drive this Corolla because I focus on intellectual pursuits.
I also love how condescending that whole sentence is, because that's not what an epiphany is, but to frame it as an epiphany makes it so much more insulting. Like, I had this sudden illuminating realization. You're stupid. Also, I have to say, one of the most satisfying things is sitting in my 11-year-old Nissan, stuck in traffic next to a Lamborghini.
The great equalizer.
It's like, hey, buddy, I hope you're enjoying that incredibly stiff suspension.
Yeah, we're both cooler because we don't have a Lamborghini. I think about this story all the time. Financial markets are so complicated that a couple of these traders correctly predicted a coup in Thailand, but they still lost money on their trade. I found out from this book there's a neighborhood in Oakland that masquerades as a separate town called Rockridge, and he says, simply by refusing to be part of Oakland, basically, they have higher property prices. I've talked about this before, but poor Oakland. Like, I look at the Warriors, and I'm like, Oakland is a freaking med school spouse. They suffered with you through all the bad years, and then as soon as things got good, you left them for someone better. One of the guys in this book, Michael Burry, has such a funny path because he realizes, oh, I want to bet against the housing market, but no one's placing those bets, so he has to call the banks. And here's a metaphor for that call. Imagine you call up your coworker, Rob, and you're like, hey, Rob, do you like bets? And he says, yeah, I like bets. And you say, cool, can I place a bet that you're going to have a really bad year? Rob says, I'm sorry, I must have misheard you. What? And you say, oh, I just want to bet that you'll have, you know, a year of personal calamity. And what's even funnier is he didn't even call Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers because he realized, oh, they're so screwed that by the time they lose the bet, they'll have nothing to pay me with.
And speaking of Michael Burry, Christian Bale played his character in the movie, and he asked if he could personally have Burry's cargo shorts and t-shirts, which he wore in the movie. And then later, Bale said that he hoped that Burry would make it to the Los Angeles premiere of the movie, quote, because I really want to sit next to him and see if he's going to punch me in the effing face. I love to, like, that only not to have been incredibly insulting to play him the way he did, but then to also get nominated for an Oscar for playing him so well.
All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from The Big Short. 1, big banks sometimes in small ways do bad things. 2, why blow a whistle when you can live in a mansion? Did Captain Von Trapp write this? 3, bad accounting is that he didn't look like his pictures of the business world. 4, get rich quick by disconnecting the money you make from the people it comes from. 5, don't buy nuclear bomb insurance.
And 6, I need to preface this by saying, Dave, you know I'm a professional touring stand-up comedian, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how about this? What do you call the ghost of a religious chaplain?
I don't know what.
An air fryer. Good night, folks.